Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and I'm joined this evening by Brian. How you doing tonight, Brian?
I'm good, Scott. Just enjoyed a great episode of Perry Mason.
Yeah, they are not skimping on the budget for this show, are they?
Wow. No, you know, to call back, we wondered would there be a flashback, and boy, we get right into it, and production value, explosions, outfits, you know. I mean, I felt like for a second, you know, I wondered, like, did they go film where the movie 1917 or
1917?
I wondered, like, did they go film where that movie was made? But it just, you know, got right off to a pounding start and answered one of the questions we had last week right away.
Yeah, I have to confess that I did a little mental jig because I said, I believe we not only will we get a flashbacks, we have to get at least one or two major flashbacks involving his war time situation. And yeah, that certainly filled in some blanks as far as why Perry Mason seems to be such a tortured soul. That was pretty, it's more so that when we came back to it towards the end of the episode, when we saw what really happened and perhaps the reasoning for his actual discharge, as Baggerly puts it during the episode, is discharged with blue paper. That was pretty brutal, especially that final one where you're wondering, did he have to do that or not?
Yeah, it was pretty brutal. And seeing him being somebody more put together and being in charge of people and ordering people and leading, and, you know, we sort of commented last week, he doesn't present as a per se badass, but in those scenes he was pretty much, you know, a leader,
yeah,
fighting, doing things that other people were afraid to do, leading men, and seeing that and seeing where it resulted in the end, you know, as that song played and you sort of saw him visiting his memories. I mean, I gotta be honest, like, two episodes in, Matthew Rhys, I mean, we love the guy.
Yeah.
Like, I was really moved by the way the flashback started and ended the episode, and hit me emotionally to take this, you know, character to a place that was surprising this early in the show.
Yeah, there's something about Matthew Rhys. I mean, although I have seen him in a few other things, I've not seen the Mr. Rogers movies out of yet, but I know I've seen him in a couple other things. But more so this and the Americans, there's few who seem to be able to handle playing and I'm going to use the same phrase again because I don't feel like going through my mental thesaurus at the moment, who can play that tortured soul the way he can, who just has that welling up of, you know, years of sadness or depression or whatever. And of course he's living through an actual depression, so a lot of people aren't too happy around that time. I swear, when we come out of that first flashback and we see him sitting on the street momentarily, it's funny because the first thing I thought was, like, I expect to hear someone singing Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? And then, as weird coincidences will go, it's shortly thereafter we hear... a couple times they discussed the Rudy Valley song Hi Ho from around that time. It's actually from 1929, i.e., you know, the Depression era, whatever. But Rudy Valley is also the guy who, one of the singers known for singing Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? And I was like, oh my God, I am way too in tune for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's established at some point, a little bit later in the episode, I guess it's with the first moment with Sister Alice, we're around New Year's. So are we going to, just to make sure that my mind is set on where we are with this show, we're talking about New Year's. Are we going into 1933 or 1932? I just got a little confused on that because I just didn't remember. for the first
You know, I had a thought that it was 32, but I never, you know, I was so wrapped up in the episode, I didn't take a minute and pause it and try to make sure I was right or wrong.
Yeah, I feel a little foolish because that's probably a really basic fact I should have known from the get-go. The only reason I think it's probably more significant, if it's 31 becoming 32, yeah, I'm just make sure I have it straight in my mind. Yeah, I think I'm right about this. If it's 31 becoming 32, then obviously, you know, the aforementioned throes of the depression are still really strong in this country. If it's 32 going to 33, still, of course, a present issue, but we're also going to Roosevelt being inaugurated shortly then, right? Because the election would have been in 32, which means he would have been inaugurated in January of 33. At least I assume it's what they were doing even back in the 30s. I think that's how it works, if I'm not mistaken.
I mean, that's a good question that, you know, I guess, you know, we're recording this fairly soon after the episode that I didn't sit and stew in it and then think about it a lot because the show was just so, I mean, it went a lot of different places and
I mean, the thing that's nice about the show that I'm kind of leaving my personal comfort zone, and perhaps you are as well, typically when we do, as we've said before, when we do a podcast, I have always been one, except with rare exceptions, who likes to at least push it to the next night, if not a couple nights forward, so I have a bit more time to think about it, maybe watch the episode multiple times, you know, get my notes together, blah, blah, blah. I've usually not been one who likes to record, literally, like in my case, because I started watching the episode late, literally 15 minutes after I finished watching the episode. However, the good thing about a series like this, because it's for me personally, it's a sweet spot kind of a genre, whatever, and it is so immaculately well done, but I'm not, it's not, for example, a show like, say, I don't know, Game of Thrones or The Wire, where there's, you know, in a given episode, there may be like 20-something characters I'm trying to follow and keep track of and who did what and where. And not so much that it's confusing, but it's hard to put that all together and then talk about it in a podcast minutes later. This has a bit more of a an easier through line to follow, even though it might get murky and muddled at times, and I know it's going to start getting that way because, well, pretty much I've been warned about that. But it's, you know, I was like, fuck y'all, it's still noir, what do you expect? So anyway, oh, by the way, just because I think it's fairly early in the episode, actually it's right after that moment where he's sitting outside on the street, they do something which I thought, wow, it's rare that I see something that I think is both subtle and really over the top all at the same time. And it's that moment where Perry Mason is literally looking for the answer to these loose threads.
Yeah.
And he's brought into that room where you see, you know, untold hundreds, thousands of spools of thread to try to figure it out. And I'm going, like, speaking as a writer, you know, whoever came up with that being the thing he was trying to track down, like, I bet they thought they were at the same time. I'm really proud of myself. It's like, I can't believe I'm getting away with this. He's literally trying to track down the answer to a loose thread. I mean, too funny.
Yeah, and surprisingly, that, you know, that carried on through the episode. He keeps looking at the matchbox with the thread in it. I mean, he sees that as the key to unlocking the case. And, you know, it is, now we have so much more technology and ability to do things. And a lot of times watching a show, when characters lack the sort of the resources we have today, it's distracting or it seems odd to see people not behaving. Mm-hmm. But they've made this world so well realized that the fact that you have to sit in a phone booth to make a phone call, that there are no easy answers to questions, that, you know, that when there's a blood at a scene, like, I mean, I was watching the scene with the officer on the fire escape and, you know, thinking, gosh, you know, they didn't have DNA. Like, you just see a blood droplet and use your best reasoning to say that it must have dropped this way. And a lot of times that's distracting to us, but they've realized this world so well that I just think that the attention to putting this in its proper time and the money they've spent to make this look this way, I've been blown away.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's excellent. I mean, I think I was reading some general articles about the show overall. A lot of dealing with, you know, Tim Van Patten, you know, really heading up the show for them and what he's done, whatever. But I think I do recall reading somewhere, I think the overall budget for the series overall was something like, I want to say like $73 million was a number somewhere like that. And I think this is an 8-episode series. I'm not sure. I keep forgetting.
I think it's 8.
Yeah, it's between this and Dark. I can't remember. Are they both 8 or is what? You know, and then I go, oh my god, Doom Patrol 15. Are you kidding me? Yay. Anyway, talk about that later. Yes, it's funny that maybe it's because I'm so old, or maybe I'm just such an old school kind of person. I just so greatly prefer watching things when you had to work a little bit harder, when you had to use phones and phone booths and figure things out, where everything wasn't available to you in an iPhone. I swear to God, anything I write, I always kind of like, can we make it a period thing? Can I just drop it back like 10, 15 years? You know, I don't. The whole cell phone thing just ruins everything because it just takes away so many little fun little things you can do, and you know, just you have too many issues where you're like, well, why doesn't he just do blah blah blah? Because he's got it all in the palm of his hand.
Right.
I love the whole little shenanigan he pulled in order to find out about that phone number. I got a really big kick out of that. I mean, I wouldn't say it was a light moment per se, but for Perry in this episode, it's about as light as you get, other than that great scene towards the end, near the end with E.B., of course.
Yeah, I like that he sort of has to use his wits to solve problems that today we would, you know, solve by looking at our phone.
And
I find that very refreshing to see this the way it's played out. And you know, and this week we finally got Tatiana Maslany, and you know, we got the new Drake. We got
two major things. One, I think one major just for this specific storyline, and one major to the overall Perry Mason mythos, as well as I suppose this storyline. I gotta say, first time I see Tatiana Maslany on screen and got a kind of a bit of a read on her character, I was already in my mind, couldn't help it. I'm already comparing her to all the other clones/personalities from Orphan Black, and I was going, where would she fall? I'm trying to figure, you know, she's not as much fun as that one, but not as much of a pill as that one, and whatever. One thing I found striking about those scenes, and my basic knowledge of that time period, and it's kind of, in a way, it's one of the things I felt they got right here, or at least it worked, is, as I've mentioned already, you know, this is a point in history where, you know, the country had been going through the Great Depression. You know, Prohibition wasn't exactly making most people all that happy either. There was a lot of poverty and, you know, people searching for jobs. They even play upon that in this episode as well, as a matter of fact. So when you see something like an evangelical show like this, because, you know, people were looking something to believe in, you know, they were easily susceptible to something like this during this time period, you know, with all the stress, the poverty, depression, etc. Something that has almost a carnival-like atmosphere. And you know, in certain parts of the country, it literally was carnivals, you know, that were going from town to town, but, you know, but striking up the band for Jesus and whatever. But this taking it to that next level where it's, you know, it's with a national radio audience. And we know that radio was a huge deal back then. But radio was basically the TV and the internet combined for people in the 1930s. It's just one of those things where you can see how it would get people going. And it was kind of interesting seeing Tatiana Maslany in a role like this. I don't know how much of a taste we got of her as an actual character. So we don't know how much of what we saw with her was genuine sincerity or just her, you know, playing the part, so to speak. I also had no idea. Wow, I just forgot the actress's name. It's not Liv Tyler, but it's similar to that. playing the character that she was her mother. It was one of those things. I was like, is she her mother or is she just calling her mother? I wasn't even sure about that. A lot of people might know her from like 6 Feet Under, for example. She was the signal of it not being fun anymore in 6 Feet Under for a few seasons. Lily, is it Lily Taylor? Is that what it is?
That you know what, it's terrible that I don't know, but that sounds right. I think it is Lily Taylor.
If only I had one of those devices where you could look at me. Anyway. I don't really know. I mean, you can obviously take the ball and run with it if you feel there's something here at this point. Other than the fact that we know the church and this character are going to be playing a part throughout the series because she's basically the second biggest name in the cast. You don't go and get that actress for this part if it's not going to be something significant. But beyond, I don't know if there's anything that really struck me from this episode. I mean, her spiel about the devil during the funeral, and I thought it kind of weird and fascinating that a funeral for a baby would actually be like the hot ticket in town is what it felt like to me.
Right.
I don't know if there's much to say about it personally beyond her performance, which I thought it was good, but I don't know if it didn't, I wouldn't say it bowled me over, but I thought it was good enough, shall we say.
I agree. I think that as an introduction, she was introduced really well. The compelling part about what we saw, in my opinion, was when she left the stage, though it didn't seem like she became another person entirely. It seemed like, you know, she'd been exhausted, and that maybe she was operating, you know, at her mother's request. And, We do see her preparing that sermon or that speech, and we see her feverishly working on that and looking at, you know, seeing newspapers and things to prepare for her next public appearance. So we don't know where she is, what her level of sincerity is.
Well,
she may be sincere, and her mom may be using her.
I was gonna say probably the one thing that was notable for me, I guess, and it kind of goes along with watching her actually work hard on the sermon. I don't know if sermon is the right phrase, or eulogy, whatever you want to call it, her spiel, as she was her mother's reaction to what she did. So she was not aware this is what she was going to do or say, which was interesting because you'd think she probably would normally know what she's going to be saying when she steps up to the altar. So that was interesting. So I was like, because in a way she's kind of lighting a fire under the authorities to do what they have to do. And then what ends up happening shortly thereafter. And I mean, I expected the reveal that, yes, they were arresting Mrs. Dodson because, you know, Perry/EB decided to drop the dime on her as far as the letters and whatnot. And even if they didn't expect them to take her, you know, before she even got to bury her son. But I kind of felt that's where they were going with that. I kind of knew that was going to happen, I thought.
Well, I think to sort of piggyback off that, I think we covered the religious part of it, and to sort of piggyback off that, it leads me to the thought that something I found very compelling in this show and they did it in three instances, was the approach to, you know, Officer Drake, and to illustrate the difficulty of navigating the racial divide with him, that they jump right into that, make it, you know, it's very timely. You know, they couldn't have been any more timely.
Right. It's interesting with that, because I mean, I had already known about the casting of Paul Drake before this episode, just based on seeing, you know, ads for the next episode, that kind of a thing. And I recognized the actor. Didn't write it down, but I think his name is like Chris Chalk or Chris Calk, something like that. He's been in a number of things. He was in the first season, I think he was in the first season of Homeland. He was in 12 Years a Slave. He's been on several TV shows. Blacklist, I think he was on once, maybe. I know he was on that show Underground.
When They See Us. What? Yeah, he was on When They See Us.
Oh, right. I've not gotten the chance to watch When They See Us as of yet.
Really good.
I do plan to watch it. It's one of those things where, being a New Yorker, I was very familiar with the case. And it's one of those things where you have to like decide, do I really want to revisit this? I know what happened. I'm aware of all of this. Just like, ugh. But, you know, I probably will someday, especially after what's been going on in the world. Anyway, back to the Paul Drake thing. It's one of those things where, how do I put this? On one hand, it's timely. You know, obviously what's going on in the world, in this country specifically, with the, however, and I always love that myself included, we keep trying to come up with that easy, safe phrase. You know, what do we call it? Do we call it racial injustice? Do we call it civil unrest? You know, and it's almost like the phrase you use might also indicate where your leanings are. So,
right.
So that's why I keep trying to avoid it, because I don't want to make it sound like I'm too this or that, although one can guess what I am. It's just, it's funny seeing, well, maybe not funny, it's interesting, that's better. It's interesting seeing what he's dealing with as a police officer and also as a black man at this time. But, and I didn't think it was badly done. I am not saying it was badly done. There wasn't really that much done to begin with. There was mostly his dealings with the two detectives, one of which we know is corrupt. We don't know, but we assume the other one isn't, but who knows if that'll be a different reveal. And what we hear talked about later on when Drake is with his wife. But you can't help but then flash back to watching the series Watchmen, you know, just a few months earlier, which at one point, as we all know, or all of us who watched that show know, we also dealt with a police officer who was a man of color. And we're going back like to the, I think that was also roughly the 1930s, if I'm not mistaken. 20s or 30s, yeah. I think it was the 30s. And granted, that was more the centerpiece of that specific episode and a major storyline throughout that show and thematically. But it was handled with just a lot more power, shall we say. Again, but it may not be fair to compare that to the little broad strokes we're getting with a supporting character here. In a way, I think it's almost unfortunate for this series that, you know, to follow that one, because you can't help but go, oh, it was fine the way they handled it. But, you know, if you really want to see it, you know what I mean? It was one of those unfortunate, like, oh, that's too bad you guys didn't get to go first kind of a thing.
No, I thought, the key of those scenes, and also I thought it was really interesting. We see Della being an advocate, you know, for the wife.
Yep.
In saying, you know, look, like, so she had an affair. He gambled. That doesn't mean she killed somebody. Seeing people go against the stereotypes of the times, and the portrayal, I should make that my accent people could think I said betrayal. Yeah. It's poor trail.
One poor trail, man.
Yes, the portrayal.
It's where you don't want to go walking in the woods. A poor trail.
Exactly, exactly. Of the characters, sort of staking out their own positions, really gives this show some depth that Della doesn't take any crap from Perry. And seeing we talked last week, the comedy in this, Shea Whigham gives us the comedy when they're in EB's office later. But
there is so much great stuff going on in EB's office later.
Yes.
I mean, that to me is probably the one. It's probably the scene that has so much going on that's actually, and it's got some important stuff going on, but there is a surprising amount of, at least for this series, levity going on.
Yes.
There'd be the stuff about Pete being a degenerate, and we actually find out why EB thinks he's a degenerate, which, and I was going, that's not so bad, big deal. That happens. And the whole business about EB, Jonathan, and associates or not. And yeah. Not answering the phone and all this. I really got a big kick out of that. I thought that was kind of, maybe it reminded me of, 1930s. It wasn't quite the level of being screwball, but that frenetic pace kind of thing from the 30s and early 40s kind of movies, where's Rosalind Russell when you need her kind of a thing.
Yeah. I mean, it had some hallmarks of sort of those, there was just a touch of, the sort of the Marx Brothers put in the soup there, just a little bit of, EB and associates. And then she does it, her answering the phone, that scene's rich, but what surprised me is if you would have told me we're going to give some emotional depth to his war experience, we're going to introduce two brand new characters and at least set one of them on a path that we know is going to directly run into Perry and complicate the story further, do all that while keep our main characters moving and the story moving, leading to a second arrest. And a huge revelation about, the wife and her contact with George Gannon, that if we're going to put all that in one episode, and that's going to be the second episode, I would have been, holy cow. I mean, like what they've done in two episodes is amazing.
And I know we like to use the phrase piggyback on what you said and what you actually skipped over there is like, yeah, we got a major revelation about the wife, but don't forget early in the episode, we got a major revelation about the husband, that he's actually Baggerly's illegitimate son, which now it doesn't just explain why Baggerly wanted to hire someone to help them to begin with. It explains the money situation, explains the connection. I was like, okay, now we got it. The other thing, I'm actually happy you didn't mention it, and I hadn't clued you in on. Don't mention. I want to mention this because one of my favorite things about this episode. Because you mentioned two characters, I will say three characters. Three characters of importance are introduced in this year.
Our district attorney.
District attorney Barnes, Stephen Root. I am a huge Stephen Root fan. The dude he's such a fun, fine character actor because he is the kind of guy he can go and play a character that you love and want to root for, and he's just great, or he can play the most dastardly scumbag ever. It doesn't, I know you're a fan of, say, Barry, for example.
Oh, yeah.
And hopefully folks who listen to this podcast, hopefully they've watched Barry, and if you haven't, if you've got any of these HBO Max or Go or Now or wherever the heck or On Demand, go watch Barry. It's definitely worth it. It's probably it's one of those top five shows I should have podcasted about podcasts, except the only reason I didn't, it's a half an hour show, and I feared we would do an hour podcast on a half hour show, and that just would not be acceptable. Or you go all the way back to his character, for me, the one that started all for most people, so I call it, in the terms of sitcoms, iconic, Jimmy James on News Radio. We love Jimmy James on News Radio. He is just, and there's, and, you know, and a million roles in between. You can pluck him out either movies like Office Space or God knows how many different TV shows. Even crap. That's to me is also one of the fun things about character actors. Even when they're in something crappy, or what they're doing is you still kind of remember them. I remember him being on a season of 24, and it was a stupid storyline, character, etc. Didn't care because it was Stephen Root. Still watched. Right. Still made it infinitely watchable. Loved his back and forth in this on a couple occasions in this episode between him and John Lithgow's Evie. The fact we're going to get to see those two play off each other, and hopefully more so in a courtroom setting, that is so much to look forward to. And then hopefully that will scratch my sweet spot of, I've got a Perry Mason series, I better see some courtroom stuff, even though it's not going to be Perry Mason, but who cares? Right. But I thought he was so good in it. It's just so much fun, such a little scumbag. Great.
Well, and that's another thing this show brought to the table was class, that you see Perry Mason sitting there by the labor notice board at one point, and you see people, even Perry bemoaning, you know, not liking what he does and not liking it there where he is.
Yep.
But you see away from the you know, saber rattling between the lawyers, you see them go to this stuffy private, you know, New York club of privilege, and this is where some of the best men of the city founded this club. And there are a lot of layers to this show, and I've been so impressed that after I finished the second episode tonight, you know, I put a post on social media saying it's really something, like, this show, and that's, I left it vague because I don't want to just tell people my opinion.
Right.
And I really feel like that if you go into this and all you know is Perry Mason is a lawyer trope, the better. That if you just go into this as a blank slate and let this hit you, it's really, there's a lot to this. I think because I had so little expectation and had such little advanced knowledge, I've been just blown away. And by the end of the second episode, I just thought, man, I can't believe what I just saw after the premiere. And, you know, all the things they're doing are amazing. And let me go briefly back to, you know, one of my favorite scenes, because what I like about EB is you see he is an advocate. Mm-hmm. And my question will be, my concern is will his ties to the old city, to those people, you see, you know, Stephen Root's characters firmly, you know, grounded in that world, will his defense of, you know, a child kidnapper, child murderer, will that hurt him in that world to the point that either he's not effective? Will the trial kill him? Will this be the thing where he gets taken down and that's sort of, you know, the driving force for Perry's life course change? Mm-hmm. Because you see there is a sort of the glee of a predator with the DA saying to EB, like, you know, you don't want to do this. You know, this is the one I'm going to get you on. And it plays to EB's ego. But there is some truth to it that, you know, the case against these people in the court of public opinion, it could go poorly.
That's an interesting notion. I hadn't really thought of it that way and that may very well be true, because I can't really speak from my knowledge of the lawyers that represented, you know, notorious people back, particularly back in the day in the 20s and 30s, like when any of those crimes actually did, you know, get to trial, like I, you know, like Sacco and Zazzetti or whatever, however the whole thing went. I totally screwed that up. I should have kept my mouth shut on that one. Or would a lawyer representing the most notorious of whatever, would they get greater fame as a result of that? I guess it really depends on how aghast the people are. This being something akin to child murder that might play against them. It's interesting. I hadn't really thought of that at all. Now I'm going to be thinking. I'm going to spend the next 20 minutes of podcast thinking. Hey, quick question, which I already know the answer to.
Sure.
So, obviously, before we get that later flashback back to the war and what Perry actually experienced there and what he did, when we get that revelation in a scene with Baggerly, and which is probably one of the better dramatic scenes, I would say, in the entire episode, when they kind of have it's almost like a dueling skeletons in the closet between the two of them. When Baggerly drops the thing about, you know, he had been told he had been, you know, a decorated war hero, etc., but in fact he was discharged with a blue ticket, I think was the phrase, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And then he says that a blue ticket that's usually something that's reserved for either, well, as he says, homosexuals or Negroes, right?
Right.
And then they kind of, which leads to Perry having that line that he's a quarter Welsh and queer only once or something like that.
Right.
I will confess, because, you know, not that smart, there was about like a moment there I was going, wait, are they saying Perry Mason's gay? No, that didn't just happen, did that? And then actually for me, I remember thinking, do I care if they make Perry Mason gay? Probably not, but that's kind of weird that they would do that. And then I kind of forgot about it. And then when we saw what happened in the flashback, I was like, oh, no. He didn't know what the fuck he was talking about. This is why he got discharged.
Exactly.
Nothing to do with that. Probably somebody called like, hey, we're not too fond of you, you know, killing your own men. So, yeah, you gotta go.
I think what that shows and what you learn later is he's damaged in a place that, like, if somebody lashes out at him, that he doesn't care what you say about him. You're not going to hurt him any more than he's hurt. Mm-hmm. So he'll make that offhanded line to show – he was making an offhanded line to say – you know, look, like, you didn't get me. Like, I could care less what you think. And but I do think that the Robert Patrick's character, Baggerly, I mean, the way he tells his story, that, you know, I wouldn't want to say this because it's this. You know, as a man, he expects to be heard, but when they hear about the letters, then they all turn on the woman. And that's not a big difference to keeping a secret. If you're a powerful man and you keep that secret, that's okay. But if you're a woman and you kept that secret, that means you're guilty of murder. And it was interesting to see EB struggle with that, you know, what do you do with that? Does it make it better or worse from the case?
Right.
Now, as a lawyer, if I'm just representing that client and there's a piece of evidence that could get my client acquitted, I've got to present that evidence. Like, you know, the effect of that on that other person, that, you know, they'll have to have their lawyer deal with that when that time comes. And the job of the defense attorney is not you're not trying to find the truth. Sometimes you are. Sometimes you can find the truth. I have cases where, you know, we can tell the story, but sometimes nobody knows who did it, you know? And if you have evidence that points another direction that was ignored, you can't ignore that to help your client. And I thought that was an interesting dilemma to put everybody in. And, you know, the question, the classic question is, and it was good to see that, you know, whoever's consulted, although you have those letters, you have to find a way to get them admissible. And, you know, the fact that you found them, if you steal evidence, you might not get it in. And you could lose your license. And if you're the attorney presenting it, you could lose your law license.
Right.
So, you know, there's going to be some interesting dilemmas. But that scene, I mean, I think if we put the bow on the episode of what was beautiful is we start with, you know, the humor, the interplay of sort of all the main players, which for me signals two things that we talked about last week, that Shea Whigham will be coming back more, that it won't be, you know, sort of like he was there as a, you know, thank you for all his good work on HBO, that maybe he's going to stick around, you know, that maybe he's going to stick around and we like him. We like his character. We like the actor. And he's another mentor of Perry, you know, he's Perry's investigator mentor. We learned that.
That's right. That's right.
So, I mean, think of all that was packed into this episode.
Man. It's a very, especially for a second episode.
Yes.
Because, I mean, I hate to make a generalization because one could probably come up with a dozen examples that go against what I'm about to say. But a lot of times series tend to maybe shoot their load in their pilot because, you know, you need to get everything in that goddamn pilot because that's what you sold the network or the provider on to begin with. And your second episode tends to tail off a bit and then usually tends to pick up again by the third or fourth one again. But it's usually kind of a come down. And this actually, I think, goes in the opposite direction. I think it's a more explosive episode to a certain extent. I think we just find out so much more. There's so many more things at play here. And it's funny because there are, beyond the Tim Van Patten connection, as well as even Shea Whigham for that matter, I can't help but think a little bit, because the time periods aren't that much different. They're only a few years apart, quite frankly, from the HBO series from years ago, Boardwalk Empire. At least as far as this episode was concerned, and I would even say surprisingly, and I'm actually hopeful that might be the course of the series for the rest of the way, though I don't expect it to be, and I'm okay if it's not. It was faster paced than I expected. We're not talking blinding here, but it was brisk. Especially when I looked and saw that it looked like it was going to be an episode that was going to be over an hour long, did not feel like it, and it felt like they did so much. And yet,
absolutely,
yeah, I was impressed with it. Again, you look, Van Patten directed this one as well. You don't really get too much better in terms of HBO directors than him. Again, if there's actually anyone who listens to this podcast who doesn't know that much about him, I'd say just look him up on IMDb, and you'll be amazed by. I mean, basically, he should have the rights to one of the letters in HBO because of how much he's directed for them.
And, oh yeah,
you know, I mean, The Sopranos alone, but then you go, not just The Sopranos. He's on this. I mean, I think he's even done. He even directed some Game of Thrones, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, he did.
So,
Boardwalk Empire, Sopranos, you name it. I mean, he's all the cornerstones of HBO. Yeah. He's been right there.
Again, it's salami. How is that possible? I think we've done an amazing job with this episode. I only have one question that I had during the course of the episode. And it's not really that important. At least it turned out to not be that important, but I was wondering about it. Follow along the chronology of what we saw in the episode at a certain point. There is a point where the detectives, I guess the detective shows up and wants, what's his name? Mr. Dodson to come downtown, you know, to identify a lineup kind of a thing, right?
Right.
We see
right.
that. After that is when we see Paul Drake or Officer Drake, whatever, you know, he stops a little, the potential little bit of domestic violence or whatever you want to call it that's going on. And then he ends up being led to find these bodies of the kidnappers, which then entails him going up to the roof and so on and so forth. And then we cut back to the Mr. Dodson being brought in, and then we find out that they're trying to screw him over and arrest him and whatever. And they're talking about finding the bodies, whatever. I was kind of confused by that because And then later on, we see the detectives talking to Officer Drake about finding the bodies. Do you see why I'm confused by that? Because...
Oh, I do, because of the suitcase. Like, how could it both be at the scene and be there at the station?
Because it seemed like they went to get him with the clear knowledge that this was going to be what they were doing. That they were, it was a ruse. That they were bringing him down because they were eventually going to arrest him because they had found the kidnapped or whatever. But in fact, we hadn't seen that happen yet because it's right. This officer who finds him. So I got confused initially, and for at least a few minutes of the episode, I was thinking, wait a minute, were they just making that up? And then it turned out that the officer actually finds him after all. Is it going to be an issue? Did they just play with time in this episode for some reason? And they did, or maybe the editing? There's like maybe this is a decision that should have been cut and put in the episode much earlier, so it would make a bit more sense chronologically speaking. I feel like it's almost an editing decision that maybe I don't agree with or something. It just seemed a little weird because, you know, we're coming to bring you in, but we know we found the bodies. But then the next thing is we find the guy, the first guy finding the bodies. And then you see what I'm talking about? It just seemed weird to me. It didn't.
I think here's how I made sense of that is they paid special attention to peg everything to this being New Year's Day. The church scene was, you know, in the first day of the new year. This was like the morning after, with Drake at the apartment. It's the morning after New Year's. Mm-hmm. So I think everything was tied to being happening early on New Year's Day. Mm-hmm. I think he goes and finds that. And they already know what they want when they go to the scene. And when they go get him, they're not taking him for they're just trying to get him to go with them so they can peacefully, you know, get him out of the scene. Because keep in mind that, you know, that they've established there are reporters outside the house and they're being watched. They have police protection, which really guards, as we learn later when he sneaked the wife after finding the letters. But I think what we establish is that they're just getting him out of there without... I mean, if they put him in handcuffs and take him out, it creates a scene. So I think they're just getting him to the station and then, you know, and then pull some real crap. And it is interesting to see, as a function of that time, the way they treat EB in that scene of the interrogation. Like, sit down, Gramps. Like, you know, you're not leaving. Basically bar them from leaving. They were never going to not arrest him. I mean, it was a ruse. That was my take from the very beginning.
Okay. Then, I get that. It's just because I don't want to spend too much time, much more time on this point. It just confused me because the episode is told, you know, excluding the flashbacks, in a fairly straightforward, you know, one event follows the other chronological fashion. And the way those kind of scenes cut from one to the other, it kind of defied that because it implied that they, you know, were taking him in with, you know, and then, you know, right after we find the officer finding the bodies, and the next scene is him, you know, making reference to finding the bodies, which I didn't see how that could have happened since we already saw him take him in shortly before that. So I just, that was what was confusing to me. It wasn't that big a deal. I just felt it was an issue of editing with the episode that maybe that scene should have been popped in somewhere earlier in the episode, and then I wouldn't have said word boo about it since. But it, again, it's not that big a deal, but I was curious about it. Curious enough to bring it up. And that's it.
No, I mean, I get it. The thing I thought was that the suitcase was in the apartment. Next thing you know, it's on a desk in the police station. But I mean, you know, for the reasons I've said before, as well as I'm sure that, you know, our corrupt officer is monitoring anything going on in that area because he knows that call's coming in. And as soon as it is, they're going to take control of that evidence and he's going to make sure it gets.
Oh, that makes perfect sense to me. Again.
Just timing. I get it.
Doing so well. Speaking of timing, we're doing so well on time until this happened. Yeah, I again, it was just an issue. Trust me, I'm one who sometimes, you're working on a story or a screenplay or something, and you realize it makes more sense for a scene you have taking place over here. Like, you know what? This actually makes more sense if I pop it over here. And you just rearrange it and whatever. And it feels like that was kind of done here. And it's like, well, maybe that should have been over here. And I think I understand why there was an issue. That's why I'm because the problem was you're having this plot element, a very important plot element to introduce, pretty much at almost the same time you're introducing a character. And that's what kind of made it a little bit trickier. Because usually you might try to separate those. You might have a character introduction here, and then later on there's a plot thing. You kind of did that all together at once, so they packed it all into here. Maybe I would have put it earlier in the episodes. That's just me being writer nitpicky here, but if that's my biggest criticism, like, I would have rearranged the order of a couple scenes. It's not that big a deal.
Hey, if I would have laid out all they were going to chart out in this episode, I would have given this a high degree of difficulty
Hey.
for what they did, and I thought like the episode absolutely nailed it.
I absolutely agree. I just want to spend 90 seconds on something and then I'll wrap it up. I just want to commend you for, and I know I said it on the social media, but I'm going to say it officially on the podcast. Back when we did the Best of 2019 podcast, which you ably stepped up to the plate since Dan like watched like two shows all last year or something. When we were doing our best TV dramas, I don't know if I wouldn't call it irony exactly, but the funny thing was that when you took a moment in the midst of a list to kind of do a shout out, it wasn't, I don't think it was, ne I don't know if it necessarily had a number on your list, or it was just a special honorable mention, or how you phrased it, not really important at this moment, but you did a special little comment about the show that at the time you were watching on the DC Universe streaming app, Doom Patrol, right? You
Yep.
extolled the virtues and how fine a show it was, etc. And I was kind of frustrated, not with you at all, but just with myself, because as many know, I am a major comic book geek nerd, old school DC fan, whatever. I am a huge fan of the Doom Patrol, specifically the original Silver Age one, but I am very well aware of the later incarnations, some of which are held in very high regard throughout, the world of comic book readers. That were written by the likes of Grant Morrison and so on in the 90s and later. I heard about the show. I obviously had heard about the show, but I did not have the streaming app. I never bothered to get it, and I was like, it was killing me because there's a few shows on that little thing I'd like to check out, but just didn't happen. And this week I found out that, hey, somehow I have access to HBO Max. Go figure. I can only watch it on my computer, but I got it. And for whatever reason, obviously corporate ownership, one of the shows from the DC Universe is appearing on the HBO Max, and that would be Doom Patrol. So I have now watched, as of this taping, I have now watched the first 10, 9 or 10 episodes from season one. There's 15 overall. I can't remember if I've watched 10 or not. I know the last one I might have watched might have been the All Jane episode, but I feel like I started watching the next one. I love this series. That's all. I just want to say if it's not the best comic book inspired TV series that I've seen, and no, I'm not including Watchmen in that category because it's kind of that's a different kind of a thing altogether. It's right there. I feel like it's right there with the likes of Legion. Maybe not as artistically ambitious, but in some ways maybe crazier.
Yep.
Legion, you have a singing mouse for like a minute or two. You know what we're gonna have? We're gonna have a crazy screaming cockroach in several episodes. Shut up.
Or literally a universe where an animal's butt is the. I mean, it's just,
It's amazing.
it's laughs and it's also tears. I mean, there's some real heavy stuff
Yeah.
in it,
It,
and
it, it's
well,
it's
well done.
it's exceptional. It's great. I hope because I'm trying to juggle watching that, and I can only watch that in my bedroom, so it makes it a bit more complicated as opposed to just being able to relax in the living room on the couch. You start watching something when you're in bed, you fall asleep, and it's a little tricky. So I'm trying to balance watching that and Dark at the same time. So, which is, my brain's going to be fried this week, I think. But I know they also just released the first three episodes of season two, and then they're going to do like one a week on the HBO Max and I guess the DC Universe app as well. I just want to say, really a big fan of the show. Just wanted to say it here. Who knows? Maybe in some future alternate or not so alternate universe, maybe we'll even dump a little Doom Patrol podcast on everybody's ears, even though maybe no one. Some people might be watching based on my recommendation. It seems like people were saying, oh, since you said so much, I'll watch. I'm like, okay, yeah, I got like five people to watch it. Thank you. HBO should send me a thank you letter. Okay.
Yeah, it's really excellent. So, yeah, I think it's time to wrap it up.
Oh, yes. So, if you enjoyed this podcast, you will enjoy hanging out on our podcast page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama podcast page. Like the page, and you can join the conversations about shows like Perry Mason, Dark, and so many others. You can also find us on iTunes. Subscribe to our feed there. It's the Serious TV Drama podcast. You can subscribe, and you can rate and review us. You can also find us in Google 500,000 other ways. You can type in Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can type in STVD Podcast. You might find us. You might find us on our actual website, stvdpodcast.podbean.com, where you'll find all 250, including this one, 253 episodes of our podcast currently reside. And finally, you can follow us on the Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. That's the fastest I've ever done that while still sounding fairly coherent. So, Brian, thank you so much for joining us here on the second Perry Mason podcast. I think we did a better job than the first one.
Absolutely. Loved it.
And I will give you the lion's share of the credit for that. But I don't know what I'm doing right now. So we will be back next week, probably around the same time, with episode 3 or chapter 3 of Perry Mason. And in between now and then, hopefully me and Dan might be able to sprinkle in at least one or two more Dark episodes, even though I have a feeling you're all going to have watched it already and just going to be making fun of us. It's ridiculous. But we're going to keep doing it. What the fuck? Anyway, once again, thank you, Brian. And thank you to everybody out there. I will start the good nights and I'll let Brian finish. So good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.